You're a teacher, trainer, English teacher, materials writer, all that.
Yep.
But that's ironically not what I want to talk to you about today. I would like to talk to you about Ukraine.
It was a very emotionally charged and kind of heavy experience being there.
You have to fight for this. You have to fight for democracy. Like, you can't just let it happen.
Coming from England, I see this in the English psyche as well, this kind of nostalgia for an imagined glorious past. The Russian manipulation of the information space has been very, very clever and very strong. All of the voices from like the Baltics and Finland and Sweden and Czechia and Poland are pretty bloody clear on what needs to be done.
Beep, 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 beep. Shut up. I'm listening to the next English podcast.
You're listening to Zdenek's English Podcast, a podcast for English learners at B1, B2 and C1 levels. Hello and welcome to another episode of Zdenek's English Podcast. And also I would like to welcome all the viewers of the Teach Zdenek YouTube channel. Today I'm joined by none other than Hugh Deller himself, who is a well-known personality in the ESL or TEFL industry. Thanks for agreeing to be a guest on the podcast, Hugh. Hi.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for the interesting bunch of things that I know you wanted to ask about. Makes a pleasant change to be asked something different that I don't have a kind of pre-formulated answer for.
Okay, well, that's a pleasure. But do you mind if I introduce you to my audience? Quickly. So just off the top of my head, you're well-known, famous in the world of ESL, because the first time I heard of you was actually back in 2016 when I was taking my Delta course, the Module 2 Delta course. I believe I was preparing for a Lexis lesson for my one of the lessons that I had to do, the assessed ones, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
You were recommended to me as a good source of material, because as we know, or maybe teachers listening to this may know you as a materials writer, right? You have written a couple of books. Is it Outcomes? Outcomes?
Yeah, we've done the Outcomes series. We've just finished third edition. Mm-hmm. And before then we did Innovations, which was 5 levels. And then we've done perspectives and a couple of roadmaps, and a methodology book,
of course. Well, you are heavily influenced by the lexical approach, right? So most people know that. Unfortunately, I haven't had the opportunity to teach using your books yet, because at the schools I mostly worked at, it was not the book to go for. Usually it was the New English File or one of those, you know?
the old enemy.
But I have to tell you, personally, as a non-native English teacher, you probably know this. Like, I when I started teaching, I quite liked teaching grammar because I understood it pretty well.
Yeah.
But the older I am and the more experience I have, I have to say that I am slowly but surely moving away from the grammar-heavy approach. So actually, you have influenced me a bit, or Michael Lewis ideas as well.
I think that often just happens to teachers almost unconsciously, to be honest, where the longer you teach, the more you realize that actually the root of most students' problems isn't that they need to do yet another controlled practice activity on the present simple or whatever, you know?
Yeah, it's true. It's just, it gets repetitive, boring, and it's not what they actually need. The more I teach, the more I'm more dogme style teacher.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's for once. And then I understand that what the students really need is to be armed with an arsenal. Pun intended, we will get to that later. An arsenal of vocabulary to be able to survive in an English speaking world.
Any YouTube session we do which mentions the arsenal is always a good day. I think actually, you know, there's quite a lot of overlap with what dogme is talking about. And I think if you're going to do any kind of dogme well, you need to really be thinking a long way beyond just correcting surface grammar. You need to be trying to understand what the person's saying to you. And at the same time, you need to be able to think of, okay, what is it that I can provide them with now that's a better way of saying what they're trying to say? You know, and that requires a kind of level of linguistic awareness and responsiveness that, you know, can be quite demanding sometimes, depending on your levels, especially.
Yeah, no, it's something you get better at as well as you teach and as you develop in the sense of your own proficiency, English language proficiency, because it takes time to get there if you're a non-native.
Yeah, it does. I mean,
teacher,
whether you're native or non-native, to be honest, it took me a long time to get there myself. So,
okay, I feel better already. All right. So, basically, I think we should mention the fact that you have an. I'm sorry if I'm saying it wrong, but I believe it's an online school, the Lexical Lab.
Yeah, basically, it's a very bespoke niche online school, basically doing kind of dogme style classes. We provide our own sort of tailor-made material every week. We only teach advanced proficiency level people. The vast majority of the people we teach are already English teachers themselves. And we kind of predominantly work from the output that students come up with to provide new input. And it's very much that kind of focus in terms of what we do. And we do a lot of teacher training and teacher development online as well.
Wonderful. Well, actually, as it happens, I came across one of your videos.
Okay.
Were you teaching yourself? I believe it was a group of Ukrainian students.
Yeah, I know that one. It was like the CPE class in Kyiv.
Yeah. And it was about, the topic was embarrassing situations or something like that.
Yeah. Always a good one.
So I know a couple of listeners listening to this may be English teachers themselves. So if that's the case, then check this one out. I think it's a very good one. Well, I can put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, cheers. I think as a teacher trainer or a teacher educator, it's really important that you can be seen to be doing what it is you're telling other people to do as well. And I would feel a bit bogus. I mean, you know, people are welcome to watch me teaching and kind of go, it's rubbish. That's fine. We can have a discussion about what you don't like about it and what you think you'd do instead. You know, not everyone has to agree, but I think it's really important that you are seen to be doing the thing that you're telling other people how you think it should be done.
Practice what you preach and all
that.
Exactly. Makes sense. Okay, let me just put on screen for those that are watching live, lexicallab.com, the website. So that's where you can read more about Hugh and learn about his online school as well.
Thank you. We're in the middle of having a big website overhaul as well. So hopefully in the next few weeks, there should be a brand new shiny website.
Okay, well, good luck. And do you know what my favorite thing about you is, though, Hugh?
Tell me.
Can you guess?
It's a football thing, is it?
Of course. Yeah. you support the same team as I do.
Yeah, where does your Arsenal connection come from?
Tomáš Rosický, because I'm from the Czech Republic.
Ah.
So I used to live in the UK.
Mozart.
that's true. The little Mozart. I used to live in the UK back in 2005 and 2006. And true. I can't remember exactly when he joined, but I think that was his early years at Arsenal. And you know, this is what happens basically. You sort of fall in love with the club as a result of you supporting that player that comes from your own country. It's the classic
story.
You
chose well.
Yeah, although there were some very good years, let's say, but now it's all looking up.
Very interesting at the moment. Yep. Yeah,
let's not jinx it because there's still a long way to go.
Yeah.
But Hugh, so I've talked about you being you're a teacher, trainer, English teacher, materials writer, all that.
Yep.
But that's ironically not what I want to talk to you about today. Basically, I would like to talk to you about Ukraine.
Okay.
Because I've been following you for a while. I think I've been one of your Facebook friends, and I've noticed that you've been sort of monitoring the war and what's been going on by, like, every day you make a post, and you always title it with the day of the war. Yeah. So I don't know when the war started. In 2002?
The full-scale invasion, February 24th, 2022. But, I mean, you know, as Ukrainians will tell you, it's been going on for 10 years.
You mean the annexation of Crimea? Yeah, but the actual, the invasion, the latest invasion, February 24th.
Yeah.
And so did you start making those
posts? Pretty much almost immediately afterwards, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what are those posts about? How would you sum them up then?
So on one level, it's just a way of keeping Ukraine in people's minds and helping people to remember that the war is still going on, because obviously there's lots of things that can distract people from that. I think it's also a way of helping me to keep a record of things I've been reading about and thinking about, and for any of the Russians I know who are still following me, and, you know, there's a lot who aren't anymore, but there are some who definitely are still. It's a way for them to start thinking about their own responsibilities and their own role in kind of both politicizing and kind of decolonizing the Russian space. For Ukrainians, it's a way of being amplified and a way of having access to broader platforms. And I guess also for me, it's a way of, when I was a kid, there was a famous poster from the First World War that you used to see a lot, which was a little kid sitting on his dad's lap. And the tagline was always, "Daddy, what did you do during the Great War?" And it was basically kind of designed to encourage people to sign up and go and fight. Yeah. And it felt very obvious to me very early on that this was a much bigger conflict than most people I knew realized, and it was going to have much bigger ramifications than most people I knew realized. And I think over the years of having gone to Russia and read a lot about social media, about Russia and social media, I was very aware of the way in which the information space was part of the hybrid war. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to play some small role in challenging Russian narratives and countering those things and allowing voices from the kind of colonized regions of the Russian Empire to speak. And actually what I then started realizing is there was a lot of echoes of things Ukrainians were talking about, which Kazakhs were also talking about, and Finns were talking about, and Estonians were talking about. And so it's also been a way for me to kind of join all those dots together. And what, you know, it's one of those things, like, once you start it, it becomes very difficult to stop. It's like, it's just, it has a kind of momentum of its own. And I just feel like, okay, I have to do this every day now.
But it's quite impressive, because it's usually very long posts.
Yeah.
I can't say I've read them all, but
everyone to read them all or anything.
But when I
dip in and out.
But when I do end up reading them, it strikes me in a sense of, it makes me think, like, how long it must have taken you to even write that. It must be at least 1 hour or something, right?
Half an hour a day.
Half an hour a day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then on Instagram, I do 2 posts a week as well. Just Tuesdays and Thursdays are, like, you know, reports from the war day, basically.
Well, this proof also proves that you must really feel very strongly about this war. And
I do.
I guess that's where we have an overlap. Obviously, me on much lower scale, but I still feel like that's why I'm doing this on the Next English Podcast, because I feel like I want to talk about this.
Yeah.
And I, like you, I know some of the listeners, former listeners, have left me. I know that. But on the other hand, perhaps it will inspire some other listeners. So I think about it in this kind of sense.
And in the end, the people that you lose are not people you want anyway. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
I made a kind of conscious decision with my Instagram where the first year or so I was talking about things, I think I lost about 1,000 followers. And it's like, well, if I'm losing people who don't like the fact I'm talking about what their country is doing in Ukraine, fine. I don't want to train them. I don't want to teach them. I don't want to be in their information space. That's fine.
Exactly. I think it's admirable in a way to make a stand, right? So
yeah.
It's like, it's who you are. This is yourself. You're being authentic. You're being authentic.
Yeah.
Rather than hiding behind something, because you have a voice, right? So I think that's the thing. Like the more you're well known, the more responsibility you sort of have.
Yeah.
But the more you have to lose as well. So it's like it goes both ways.
Yeah, right? True, obviously. Yeah. I mean, if I was thinking in purely pragmatic business terms, it's always easier to keep your mouth shut. But I also became aware quite early on, I think, that it's because of keeping people's mouths shut because of money that we've been put in the situation that we're in. And I think one of the fatal mistakes the West made, you know, the West as a broad concept, is we turned a blind eye to a lot of what was happening inside Russia, what Russia was doing outside Russia, because money, you know. And I think the Russians,
there's no doubt about that. You know, so many Russian oligarchs in the West and
washing all their money and laundering it all and tying
washing
into their energy.
Roman Abramovich and all these people.
Indeed, you know, as if you needed another reason to hate Chelsea. And so again, it's like I didn't want to feel tainted by that, in a sense. And I think also for me, I spent 20 years going backwards and forwards to Russia and know the country very well, and I've traveled very widely in the country, and I kind of felt like I had a moral responsibility to talk about it because of the fact I've been there so much. And I think I had a kind of retrospective guilt about the fact that I wasn't aware quickly enough of where things were headed. And I think, I mean, I know a lot of Ukrainian friends I talked to.
A lot of people weren't aware.
After February 24th, it was suddenly like the scales dropped from your eyes and suddenly you see things very clearly and you're like, this is where we are and this is where all of that was leading. And you start to kind of unravel the path that led you there. And you realize your own complicity in the creation of that path, and you try to do something to rectify that.
Yeah. Well, I personally was teaching at a school in the Czech Republic where we were preparing students, mostly Russian-speaking students, to study at Czech universities.
Yeah.
And I was working at this school for about 7 years. Yeah. That was before the war.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have ever guessed what was going on. I think even the students themselves had no idea. I had students who would, you know, when there was it in the COVID time? Yeah, when COVID happened, the war wasn't there yet, right?
Yeah.
So I remember teaching
the good lesson. Years.
right. Sounds weird to say. Yeah. But basically what happened was that I was teaching an online lesson, on Zoom, and that I had some students signing in with the Putin avatar. And at the time I was like, I don't like it, right? I didn't like it, but I let it happen, right? Yeah. So I was like, I don't really like it. I'm like, well, do you have to have that? Like, I made a comment about it, but those students also happened to be the most misbehaving students by coincidence. But the thing is, like, if it happened today, like, I would have responded in a completely different way. I would have given in my notice, you know.
You know what I mean.
So nobody realized, I guess, what was going on back then.
Yeah.
But so there's no doubt who the aggressor is. You know, for me, the Ukrainians are just defending themselves.
It's the most crystal clear situation in my lifetime, essentially. And I think also the stakes are very, very obvious, and the consequences of the aggression are very, very obvious. And it seems to me that in the West, we're still not quite at a point where collectively we understand that. You know, I think there's a lot of people who have this kind of belief about, well, if we just force Ukraine to sacrifice 40% of its country, the problems will go away and we'll go back to everything being normal. You know, not a chance. It's not going to happen.
It's not just that. I see people who genuinely think that Russia isn't the perpetrator,
the aggressor.
You have countries. I'm sorry. I have to name this country, but this is a country that the Czechs, we have always got on really well with them. Slovakia. Yeah. What the hell is happening there? I don't get it.
FICO. Yeah.
It's such a high number of people.
Yeah, FICO is the new Orban. Yeah.
Fico. Yeah. Basically, they support this guy, or they in the elections they've given him the most votes. The guy who openly supports Russia.
Yeah, I know.
And if you ask Russians, and there were some polls made, like if they are with Ukraine or with Russia, it's kind of like 50-50 or something. And even in my country, in the Czech Republic, you would still have areas where people are just brainwashed, and the Russophiles, for some reason, despite our Czech history, the 1968 and all that, it just makes no sense.
You look at Hungary and you think about the history of 56 and about the tanks rolling into Budapest and all of their experience of seeing their own uprising crushed. And then you end up with Orban for 20 years. I mean, I guess sometimes people just go for better the devil you know. And sometimes there's a weird residual nostalgia for a kind of, coming from England, I see this in the English psyche as well, this kind of nostalgia for an imagined glorious past, you know, as a way of escaping from the problems confronting you in the present. And I also just think the Russian manipulation of the information space has been very, very clever and very strong. And I see it among people I know here. I mean, in the UK, people who basically have never been to Ukraine or Russia, don't know any Ukrainians, don't know any Russians, but they'll say things like, yeah, the thing is, though, Hugh, like a lot of Ukrainians are ethnic Russians. And you go, what does that mean? Well, they speak Russian. It's like, rot. So if someone speaks English, are they ethnic English? Are Jamaicans ethnically English? Are Americans ethnic English people? I mean, it's nonsense. But these ideas have been very cleverly seeded in the Western information space. And I think they've worked out ways of catching, you know, kind of exploiting and manipulating people's dissatisfaction with our own problems. And, you know, there are obviously problems in all of our democracies and all of our realities, because democracy is an imperfect system. But I think what they've done is they've very cleverly worked out the people on the left and the right kind of extremes of those things, and they feed them different bits of information. So if you're on the right, they feed you conservative values, anti-woke, opposing the 74 genders, strong family values, Christianity, you know, strong leader, strong patriarch. If you're on the left, they feed you America controls everything. America is the great Satan. Only Americans are imperial. Everyone else is anti-imperial. Yeah. American bombs are imperial bombs. Russian bombs are anti-imperial bombs. You know, and people buy this shit. It's just like...
Yeah, I think it's also the echo chamber. Let's be honest. We are members of those groups, let's say on Facebook or somewhere, that we sort of, our opinions are aligned with what's being spread there. And there's just what you do by nature. If you don't like something, you're going to block that person.
Giving you more of what you've liked before, of course.
Exactly. And you block the people you don't like, or you just stop talking to them. You stop seeing those posts. And then you end up seeing only the things that you want to see based on your own perception. But let's be honest. I mean, you should all be prepared. Well, I should be prepared to change my view based on the facts that are presented to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, of course. I mean, for me, it's been one of the other things that's been a real problem is for two elections, I basically supported Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party, and I was a Labour Party member. I voted for Corbyn both times. I've been really disgusted and shocked and appalled by his reaction to Ukraine, which is, I don't know if you know this phrase about tankies. Tankies are like the hard left who, when the tanks rolled into Budapest, sort of sided with the Soviets, you know. And so it's like, you know, that they can excuse any form of tanks if they're Russian. And Corbyn is basically a classic tankie, I now realize, because his angle is, I want peace, therefore we should stop arming Ukraine. And you're like, that's not peace. That's not peace. That's capitulation to a semi-fascist invader. You know, that's condemning Ukraine to a death sentence. That's not peace. And so in the end, I think there's a whole section of the left here, which, you know, is kind of where I'm from, which is it sort of would like to imagine it's anti-fascist, but actually is basically just pacifist and anti-Western imperialist and doesn't know how to deal with a kind of fascist foreign aggressor. And they're the people who during the Second World War would have been offering bits of Kent to Hitler in the hope that that would keep him happy. You know, and it's like, these people don't work like that. This isn't what we're dealing with. We're dealing with mafia guys. Yeah. You know, the only thing mafia guys understand is like a bullet through the head. It's just
threats. Threats, possibly, things like that. Yeah.
And you know, anytime you kind of go, oh, but they've got nuclear weapons, they just
we're basically too weak for them.
I keep saying this.
We're basically too weak for them, right?
Yeah.
Because democracy is like a weak system.
It is, and I think the Russians are very clever at understanding that, and that the wheels roll slowly in Western democracies, and even just trying to increase military production takes time, and trying to persuade your population that it's necessary to do this takes time. Over there, you know, Putin can just basically say this year we're spending 30% of the annual budget on weapons, and you lot over there go off and fight, and it will happen. And we're up against that. And so I think we're currently at the stage where we're panicking and realizing that we're having to really increase our situation. And then also you've got America, you know, America for so long a sort of reliable ally, suddenly acting like a kind of basket case about to collapse into its own kind of civil war and not reliable at all. And I think for most of Europe now, we're looking at this situation where we could be abandoned by a Trump America. We could have Russian aggression pushing right up to Polish borders, taking Transnistria, swallowing up Moldova, you know, and are we ready to fight it? I think the answer is, you know, possibly, but not as well as we should be.
We are not even united in the opinions. Like, if you, that's one of the issues, right?
It is. And I mean, I watch people arguing about whether we should be sending long-range missiles, whether we should be saying we'll put troops on the ground. It's just like, guys, you know, sort your messaging out and sort your shit out. And all of the voices from like the Baltics and Finland and Sweden and Czechia and Poland are pretty bloody clear on what needs to be done. And I kind of feel like if we've learned one thing from the last few years, it's Western Europe hasn't listened to Eastern Europe loudly enough. Because I think like a lot of people in Eastern Europe have been kind of telling us, we're kind of worried about the Russians. Yeah, they'll be fine. Just buy their oil, be happy. You know, and
this is like in our DNA because of it's a trauma, right? Maybe not my generation, but the one before. And as you know, it's kind of the trauma passes
in the
genes, right?
Yeah.
So,
and I think being English and like being from London, there's a strong family memory. I mean, my grandparents stayed in London right through the Blitz, and so for me, when I saw what was happening in Kharkiv, it's like, it's a city being bombed by fascists. You know, it's like it's very easy for me to kind of empathize with and identify with what's being done to those cities, because I know from my own family history, that's what my grandparents lived through.
Well, you're a unique case in this. And one of the things you did recently was that you actually went, like a few days ago that you came back, literally came back from Ukraine, right?
You were teaching there. Yeah.
Last Sunday. So what was the purpose of your visit there?
Two or threefold. So I wanted to, I was invited by TESOL Ukraine to do a training course, and I kind of ummed and ahed about it. And I thought, oh, I don't know. And then I thought, you know what, I'll just go and do it. And it was in Lviv, and Lviv is 40 miles from the Polish border. You know, it's closer to Warsaw than it is to the front line. So I figured it would be basically safe. I knew that they could get 200 people there from all over Ukraine. I knew that for Ukrainian teachers, it would be the first face-to-face event with a foreign trainer that they've had since the full-scale invasion. So it's a good kind of chance to show some solidarity, to provide them with an experience, to network, to talk about teaching. And I also knew that we'd be able to do it as a fundraiser for the Ukrainian armed forces. Mm-hmm. And so on all of those levels, it was just something I wanted to do. And I've got a lot of friends there that I haven't seen for ages and students there. And I just, you know, I wanted to kind of just be able to meet people. And I'm very, very glad I did it. But it was a very emotionally charged and kind of heavy experience being there. And it's weird because, I mean, like, if you're in Lviv, on the surface, you don't notice the war. You know, like, the center of Lviv hasn't been shelled. The buildings are all intact. It's beautiful, the center of Lviv. But when you start looking closer, the war's everywhere, you know. Yeah. So there are shelters in all of the buildings you go in. You're, as soon as you get in the country, you're told to download the air raid alert app. You see people jogging with prosthetic limbs. You know, you see groups of kids in the main square, and two or three of them were being camouflaged and they're going off to serve. You go to the beautiful old graveyard that's there in Lviv, and there's a whole extra added section called the Field of Mars, where all the new graves are for the defenders of Ukraine. And, you know, it's with flags on all the graves and people crying at the gravesides. And then you start talking to teachers and you realize what teachers are going through and have been through and how many people have lost people. You know, like, everyone you talk to, someone they were at high school with has already died serving for Ukraine. People like 25-year-olds have been married a year and their husband's in the trenches near Avdiivka. People who were married for 20 years, their husband signed up and he was killed last year defending Bakhmut. People who've been teaching in underground shelters in Kharkiv for the last 6 months. You know, just endless stories like this. People who lived under Russian occupation for 3 weeks before they were liberated in Kherson. You know, this kind of thing. People who have relatives in Russia who used to come and visit them every year and who now send them gloating emails saying, I hope you Nazis die soon. You know, just loads and loads of stories like this. And when you realize, you know, they're kind of, a lot of the time they feel like they're going through this on their own. And they feel like, well, why is no one else helping us deal with what we're having to deal with? And of course, you know, other countries are helping and weapons are being provided. And I know there's all kinds of behind the scenes training and all of that going on. But it could have been sorted out much quicker, much earlier on, had we taken more decisive action and gone in stronger, I think. And I think the longer you leave it and the more the Russians sense that they can just bleed the country dry, the more we're encouraging the Russians to engage in a long war and bleed the country dry. And it's going to just cause more problems for everyone in the long term. So, yeah, I wanted to do it on all of those kinds of levels. And apparently I've agreed to go back this time to Kyiv in the autumn. So, you know, we'll see what happens in the intervening months. But I've kind of also just, I've kind of lost the fear of being there in a way, because watching how the Ukrainians live. Well, yeah. One of my students is in Kharkiv and, you know, she said that's being shelled all the time. And sometimes she's out in the street and they'll hear an explosion. And she's a middle-aged teacher with two adult kids. And she said when she hears the explosion, she can tell immediately, oh, it's a mile away. And she says what everybody does is they turn towards the Russian border. They give them the finger like this. Yeah. And they shout kind of, Slava Ukraine, Herom Slava. And then they just go on with their shopping, you know.
It must be such a numbing. It's like it numbs you down, right? Or what's the expression?
But at the same time, there's this kind of, I mean, I felt it very strongly in Lviv. There's this kind of feeling of we have to live and we have to live as fully and as well as we can. Yeah. And we understand the price of our freedom. And we will resist and we will remain defiant and we will remain independent. And you really feel that very strongly. The first day I was there, I went down to the main square and there was a kind of 16-year-old kid singing the Ukrainian national anthem, and everyone was standing there just singing and crying. And at the end, they do all the chanting. And you just look at this and you think, you know, they're never going to give in, these people. They're not going to just roll over and say, oh, go on, we are Russian, really brotherly people. It's such an insane idea that they're ever going to want to compromise or be colonized again.
They have their own language. They have their own language, like their own culture, their own identity. Like, what? Yeah. Why on earth do people think that they are the same bunch? Like, it makes no sense.
Because the Russians keep saying it, you know, they keep saying, even when you watch videos of Russians who kind of go, we just want peace, we're fraternal people. And it's like, you must have a very weird relationship with your brother. You know, this is all I can say. If this is your idea of fraternal people, you know, what, you're going to kill them into loving you? How's it going to work, this fraternal relationship of yours? And it's scary to see how brainwashed a lot of Russians are. Even people I know who've left are still kind of
exactly.
They're still posting about the greatness of St. Petersburg. And
even people, you know, living outside Russia.
Yeah, I know.
I know people who are either indifferent. I never understood this. So at least give some kind of indication that you're against this. Yeah. That's what, like, I thought most people would do. They didn't. Maybe partially out of fear, which is something I could a little bit understand. But on the other hand, like, you have to fight for this. You have to fight for democracy. Like, you can't just let it happen. You have to fight for this. You have to fight for democracy. Like, you can't just let it happen. Yeah. That's just one thing sometimes I struggle to understand. Yeah.
That there's a lot of learned helplessness and a lot of kind of, we're just little people. We can't change anything. Yeah. And I mean, for me, the one thing that you really feel strongly in Ukraine is, Ukrainians understand the importance of individual agency. And, you know, if lots of people do little things together, it will make a big change. And you're not helpless. History is made by small people, not by big people. You know, collectively, we organize and we fight. And that's very deep in the culture there, I think, and in the society. And I mean, you know, when you start to understand the history a bit more, you realize, well, the Russians have been kept down much more thoroughly for a longer period of time. And the Ukrainians have had the kind of, you know, the Cossack Hetmanate, and they've always had this kind of tradition of sort of semi-democratic kind of self-organizing, you know, village anarchists almost, you know. And they've always had this tradition of resisting. You know, what one of my friends said the other day, like when I was there in Lviv, the way Ukrainians see it is the Maidan is never finished. You know, that basically we had the 2014 Maidan to kick out Yanukovych. Once the war's over, if we feel that our politicians aren't doing their job, we'll go back out into the Maidan and we'll let them know. And that's really inspiring for me, because I think, you know, I see it in England, a kind of an erosion of trust in democracy and
not only people, in England, it's happening all over the place.
People not knowing what to do with that lack of trust. And rather than trying to engage democratically and replenish the institutions that nourish us, people turn to conspiracy theories or
they believe liars.
Yeah.
Outright liars. It's been proven that these people lie. Without naming anyone, like, we could.
We all know who they are.
The Johnsons and the Trumps and all these. You can see the truth and you still choose to go against it. Like, that makes absolutely no sense to me.
No, me neither. You know, I guess there's a kind of emotional appeal that draws people in, and they're very clever at manipulating people's emotions in that respect. I mean, mercifully, generally, certainly in Johnson's case, they get found out and, you know, people see through it eventually. And luckily, the institutions that they're trying to subvert are still strong enough to resist them. You know, that's
but there's always a cost. There's always a cost to it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, this must have been a really humbling experience for you, Hugh.
Yeah, it was.
I was watching some of the videos that you made as a response to
me kind of just crying in front of
crying, but like being very emotional about it. Like those are one of the best videos because it shows the genuinity of your message, right?
So yeah,
it gives it a real sort of value. And a couple more questions. I wanted to ask you about, well, we are both football fans, and I often hear this message from a lot of other football fans who keep saying, hey, don't mix up football and politics. But for me, like, how can you not? Like, that if there is a banner, we stand with Ukraine or something, or they put a little flag, Ukrainian flag, next to the, at the top of the broadcast.
Yeah.
They put it there next to the teams. Yeah. I see no problem with that. Why do you think
it's delusional to pretend that somehow sport exists outside of the rest of the world? I mean, one of the things that the Putin regime, same as the Nazi regime in Germany, has been very good at doing is using sports and sports washing as a way of legitimizing its own regime. So I think, you know, one of the huge mistakes we made in the West was letting Russia carry on with the World Cup in 2018 and sort of allowing it to legitimize itself and look like a normal country and host all these people and sort of go, look at us. You know, we're a lovely place. People love us. Even now, I mean, there are loads and loads of athletes who compete or used to compete on the international stage who have made pro-Putin statements, who have been seen at parties with Putin. There was a big thing recently of a whole load of international skiers forming a Z on a snow slope.
Yeah, I've seen that, like, you know, cross-country skiers,
The weightlifting kid who had the Z on his shirt. And all of these people, even if that's not the case, if you're Ukrainian, your sports centers are being targeted, they're being bombed, your athletes are being killed because they're having to resist the invaders. Whole football teams like Mariupol and Shakhtar Donetsk are being forced out of the cities where their fan bases are and where their grounds are. So how is sport not political? You know, I mean, when you've got one country killing the other country's athletes and blowing up its football pitches and its tennis courts and, you know, forcing its athletes to become refugees, to then say, yes, but please now allow our players to join your sports competitions because they're non-political. I mean, it's just nonsensical. And you also know that, you know, if Russian athletes or Belarusian athletes are allowed to perform in the Olympics and they do well, they will be used as propaganda by the system. There is no way they won't be.
Sports washing, as you said, yeah, exactly. But another sort of view I hear a lot is that, well, aren't you being a hypocrite then with the Ukrainian stuff? Why don't you care about what's happening, in the Middle East? And then there was a Qatar World Cup as well, which was obviously another case of sports washing in a different way. And then you have stuff happening in China with Taiwan. And, you know, like there are a lot of conflicts in the world. So why is it Ukraine? I hear this a lot, especially from the Muslim world. Yeah. And they will point out, like, why should I subscribe to this?
And
if you don't care about what's happening in my... Exactly. So
I understand that.
For example, Hugh, I'm sorry, but I cannot help being a little bit a hypocrite. And I admit it. And I don't think... Because the thing is, this Ukrainian stuff, it's happening near the borders of the Czech Republic. Yeah. We've got a history with them. And I know there's other stuff happening in the world, but I just don't feel as strongly about it as I do about this, you know? So it's hard to.
I think there's three or four things to say about that. I think one is that this kind of, yeah, but what about, kind of whataboutery or whataboutism, it's an old Soviet technique used to deflect attention away from what it is you're trying to discuss. And it's clever because if you kind of go, what Russia's doing in Ukraine is terrible, people go, yeah, but what about Iraq? And then before you know it, you end up talking about Britain's invasion of Iraq, which I completely opposed for the record. And what you're not doing is talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine that's happening in the here and now. So on one level, that's just a useful deflection technique. Okay. I think the second thing to say is we're all limited by our own experiences, knowledges, understandings, and geographies of the world. And none of us have sufficient emotional bandwidth to process everything. Okay. You know, my brother's been involved in Palestinian rights for years and years and years and years and years. And what's happening in Gaza and what's being done to Palestinian civilians is clearly horrific. At the same time, for me, I feel that the reason I talk about Ukraine and talk about what's happening is because I've spent a lot of time in those countries and I know loads of people in those countries. I do know a few teachers from Gaza who've been forced out. I know a teacher who's been killed there. I also know teachers in Israel who were kind of, you know, terrified after October the 7th and all of that. I know what China's doing with the Uyghur people is terrible. I know what's happening in Tigray in Ethiopia is probably one of the great unspoken about conflicts that we just never hear anything about because it doesn't impact us. And I think it's fine to be mostly involved in the things that are closest to you. If I was a Muslim from the Middle East, I would be much more appalled by what's being done to Palestinians than I would be about anything else because it's close to you. At the same time, I think there are other problems with this, which is Russia understands and exploits this very clearly. Okay. And I think the fact that the West has been hypocritical about this and immediately we condemn Russia's mass murder of Ukrainian civilians and call Putin a war criminal. But then we kind of sit back and we're not sure what we're going to say about Israel. They've only killed 4,000 Palestinians. Oh, God, now they've killed 24,000. Ooh, it's not looking good. At what point do we kind of go, this is just completely wrong and out of order? And while we're taking our time reaching the point which we should have reached a long time ago, Russia's busy kind of stirring the pot. And, you know, I mean, I think it's significant also the Hamas attacks took place on Putin's birthday. Okay. October the 7th is Putin's birthday. And my own feeling is that's not coincidental and that it was a great gift to Russia to have this conflict reignited in the Middle East because it allowed Russia to kind of exploit our own one-sidedness and weakness. I mean, I think personally, one way the West could deal with this much better is to take a much stronger line on what Israel's doing in Gaza. And then the Muslim world would sort of go, okay, they're not as hypocritical as we thought they were. I think another problem is a lot of the pro-Palestinian voices like Roger Waters and Noam Chomsky and these kind of guys are also pro-Putin and pro-Iran and pro-China because they're anti-Western imperialists.
I'm so confused about this, Hugh. Personally, I don't even know where I stand. So I cannot even tell you I stand with either of the sides because for me,
simple line for me is killing civilians is wrong. You know, it's a kind of bottom line. It's like killing civilians on October the 7th is wrong. Killing thousands of Gazans is wrong. You know, that's a simple line for me.
It makes sense. It makes sense. Yeah.
And so far, generally, you know, Ukraine hasn't resorted to mass targeting of Russian civilians. Whether if the war went on 20 years, they may well just end up randomly shelling Russian cities and killing Russian civilians. So, you know, so far they haven't done that. And
yeah, they're defending themselves. So, for me, it's really hard to even start comparing those two conflicts because
one's much longer.
Much clearer to me. One is like straightforward.
Your own geography and your own experiences, you know.
And also they went into their country and they're just defending themselves under the pretense of eradicating fascism in Ukraine, right? Fascism, it makes no sense. It just makes no sense. It's just Russian imperialism, in my opinion, and just greediness.
I think also there's a failing on a lot of Western people to understand that imperialism isn't only a Western thing. Like, of course, there's a kind of American imperialism and there's a UK imperialism, but there's a Chinese imperialism and there's a Russian imperialism and there's an Iranian imperialism. And,
tend to be the bigger countries, the richer countries,
with
more influence. Yeah.
And, you know, you can oppose all of them, actually. I mean, when I get emails from people kind of going, well, what about Iraq or what about this? It's like, well, I thought Iraq was a disastrous idea and it was 20 years ago. And the fact that Iraq happened doesn't in any way justify or excuse what's happening now. I don't get the argument. You know, you can oppose all of these things and think they're all wrong, but this is the one that's happening now on our doorstep. And, you know, if by some disaster Ukraine were to actually fall, well, then you've got 40 million Ukrainian refugees in Europe. And, you know, Europe may think we've got problems now. How are we going to cope with 40 million dispossessed people and Russia on our border? You know, it's you know, and then with Russia kind of stirring up the far right in all of the countries that have been forced to take in 40 million Ukrainian refugees.
It always happens, doesn't it? Like when you have a lot of immigrants, a lot of refugees, it will inevitably lead to something like that. There will be backlash from the
I was
citizens.
Talking about it with Ukrainians I know, and they were kind of saying that what they realize now is they weren't paying sufficient attention to things like Syria, okay? They were kind of thinking Syria's distant to us. We don't really understand it. Now they look at it and go, right, so Russia was supporting a dictator in Syria, creating a refugee crisis for Europe, and then using social media and its connections with the far right to exploit the refugee crisis it had created in Syria in order to destabilize Europe. Okay, now I've got it. And for Ukrainians, like at the time, there were very few Ukrainians who, you know, like very few Europeans who really understood what was happening in Syria or Russia's involvement in Syria and that kind of double war they were playing of gaining regional influence in an area the West was reluctant to get involved in, creating a refugee crisis and then exploiting that refugee crisis. That's now much clearer because we've seen the same thing with Ukraine. Create the refugee crisis, exploit the refugee crisis.
Same you pattern. Know. Yeah. It's
yeah. Same it's pattern, just again and again and again. And it's like, you know, until this is stopped, this is going to keep happening.
So what's your take quickly? What's your take on the nuclear threats then from Putin and from Russia? Does it have any substance or?
I think the talk is the weapon. Okay. It's a kind of blackmail. And I think, if you give in to this, you're making the risk of nuclear war more likely rather than less likely, because it's basically like a guy kind of going, I could fuck you up. OK, and you go, OK, let me just do whatever you want me to do. What then happens is the guy is going to come back and take more from you next time and more from you next time. In the end, with those guys, you know,
he knows you're weak.
He knows you're weak. And so. I think the talk is the weapon in this instance. And I mean, sure, they're a nuclear power, but nuclear powers lose wars all the time. This idea that a nuclear power can't lose a war, it's nonsense. You know, the Russians lost in Afghanistan.
I'm in Vietnam.
Afghanistan.
I'm currently in Vietnam, right? So we know what happened here. Americans lost the war here. So.
America's a nuclear power. They lost the war in Vietnam. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, 1 minute, let me just answer the doors in there. Come on, second.
No worries.
Yeah. I'll be back.
Yeah. So as you can see, listeners are here. This is a very, very heavy subject. And it's a real pleasure that I have the opportunity and honor to talk to you about this. And I'm still learning things and facts. I was just trying to keep the audience while you were away. I didn't expect you to be back so quickly. Yeah. Basically, we could talk about this for ages. And you know, the bottom line for me is that we don't talk about this enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And often I'm guilty of this. If it's something that I don't necessarily agree with, I tend to lose patience because I don't want to hear. I don't want to hear what the other person has to say. I don't want to. I don't want to be proven wrong. Right? Yeah. It's like our sort of, I don't know, what is it, ego or?
It's hard to admit you've been wrong or you've been duped. Yeah. It's hard to kind of publicly change your mind. Yeah.
And then you, and also you catch yourself being a hypocrite as well. Occasionally, it's hard, right? Especially when you're, especially when you're churning out some online content. That's another question I wanted to ask you. So I'm not that famous online. I've got a little podcast, the Next English Podcast, but there are much more famous podcasters out there, and some of them they avoid these subjects because they know it's a minefield, right? They could lose so much by expressing any kind of opinion. And I sort of understand them, but on the other hand, sometimes I question it too, because I wonder if it's not their responsibility to say something. I honestly don't know, because I believe it could be both. I don't know where to stand on this. What do you think, Hugh?
So I think silence is a form of complicity. And I think looking at what's happening in Russia, whatever you think of the justifications for people staying silent, in the end, the silence becomes a form of complicity because it allows the system to continue as it is. And I think people who choose not to speak about things that they have opinions about because they're worried it may damage them economically, or some people may get upset by what they say, it's a form of cowardice and it's a form of complicity in the end. And as far as possible, you should try to avoid being complicit in things that you care about.
Well, what if it's, just to play devil's advocate, so what if it's your business, like, so what if your business is entirely based on this? You have, let's say, you have listeners or viewers from Russia, from Russian-speaking countries, or let's say from the Middle East, and whatever you say, whichever side, so you could have a balanced argument. Like, from my experience, though, even presenting a balanced argument, looking at it from all sides, you end up upsetting everyone. You can never win this, basically, you know? So I sort of understand this in a way as well, because it's almost like no matter what you say, you're going to mess up. You can't get this possibly right. But then what you are saying as well makes sense to me, because, if you're silent, like, you let it all happen. You let it all play out, right? So it's such a mess. For me, it's such a conundrum, or what's the word is.
It is. And I think in a way what you have to do is you have to be available to model the kinds of conversations and respectful disagreements and exchanges of experiences that you want to see. I mean, we have this ongoing argument with our school, our online school, because we still get some Russians booking with us. And my general hope, we often talk about, should we just ban people on the basis of nationality? No, that's not a good road to go down. Some of the classes I teach, I have Ukrainians and Russians in there, and they get on really well. And you can see that the Russian students are basically kind of simpatical and kind of, you know, carry themselves in a way which is respectful to and understanding of the trauma of the Ukrainian students. Every now and then, there'll be little weird moments where you're teaching someone who kind of goes, "We don't have homophobia in Russia." And you're like, seriously, this is serious. Okay. Saying this to a Ukrainian, basically, or to a gay Belarusian who's had to flee Belarus and is now living in Poland. And in those situations, I guess, in a way, it's easier just to kind of go, you get out of my class and don't come back to my school. At the same time, I think, in teaching, as in any kind of public space like this, it's better to be try to be the best human you can and to explain why you think personally that's wrong and give examples of why you think it's wrong and allow that other person's space to come back at you and at least make your own position and beliefs clear so that you don't feel that you've sat there nodding whilst someone says something that you find really problematic. And, you know, in the end, you may or may not change that person's mind immediately, but you're planting seeds. And I mean, I've seen it myself when I'm teaching. Years ago, I had a young Saudi lad in my class I can't even remember why he suddenly said it, but he basically said, I don't like the gays. They should die. And it was like, that's a lovely thing to say, mate, because, you know, that's quite a few of my friends you're wishing death to. You know, you probably didn't realize it when you said it, but I've got gay friends. You know the gays. So, you know, I'm familiar with some of them. Yes. Why are they like this? I'm guessing you think you're straight. Of course. Why are you straight? Because I like women. Right. Gay people are gay because they like men. That's how it works, mate. You know, it's just the way it is, you know. Yeah. So you're welcome to wish friends of mine dead if you want. But just think about how that's supposed to make me feel. And you don't know the sexuality of everyone you're in the room with. OK, so maybe people in the room have got gay brothers, gay sisters, gay friends, and you've just wished them dead. So that's fine if that's what you really think. If not, maybe you want to think about the choice of words you use. And at the end, this guy actually came up and basically said, look, I'm really sorry. I realized now it was a stupid thing to say. You know, I've never been challenged on saying those kinds of things before. So I just kind of thought it was all right. And it's like, well, it's not all right, you know. And what you realize is that a lot of the time, change only happens because of conversations that you're brave enough to have.
Yeah. But you have to, you also have to do it in a way, in my opinion. This is the hard part. Yeah. You can feel attacked personally, yeah. Right? As you said, you may really have even like a gay brother or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gay yourself. And then how do you do it?
Yeah.
Without losing it, right?
Because I know.
Sometimes really hard because this
and sometimes I can't. I mean, sometimes
it's so personal to you, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But this is the only way to make it happen. The only way to make any kind of impact on that person's opinion is to by doing it in a respectful way.
Yeah.
But showing the real truth, but speaking to that person respectfully, right? Otherwise, they will never listen to you, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, trust me. I try and do this as much as I can, and sometimes I just end up kind of going, "Ah, fuck Russia, Slava Ukraine, block and delete," you know, because I come to a point where I'm just like, I can't have this conversation with you anymore because you're basically a fascist who's justifying mass murder.
Yeah.
And at this stage, I just can't. I can't. I don't have the emotional ability to do it.
Energy, you know, you can like change the world. You can't change everyone. It's like. Yeah. It's like in the same way you can't please everyone. You can try, you can do your best, but then at some point you have to get that energy back, and we're just humans, right?
And at some point you just have to accept, like, I lost it there. You know, it's sorry, I lost it. That's how not to conclude an argument. But hey, you know, in that situation, I felt like I was dealing with someone who I could have no possible impact on, and it infuriated me and disgusted me, and I lost it. But hey, before then, I tried. You know.
Yeah, so I can give you an example. So I had someone, I'm teaching in Vietnam, and you also have to be careful in Vietnam. It's in your contract that you cannot talk about politics and things like that here, right?
Yeah.
Yet, I had someone in my class showing like Nazi gestures, you know, the Heil Hitler.
Things.
And repeatedly. And that person knew it was winding me up. Because at first I was like sort of making a face just to show my sort of disgust at it. But then as he kept going, kept pushing, I had to confront that person. And so this is something like I cannot just ignore, for example.
And I don't think you should, you know. I don't think we should be, as teachers, I don't think we should be asked to. It's different from saying go in and impose your opinion on people to say,
no, I wouldn't. I respect the culture.
To deal with situations in class where people make really offensive comments. What? So not being political means when someone else is political, I don't react to it. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. You know, I mean, that's another form of politics. So that's basically the politics of appeasement and complicity in what that person's saying or doing.
Yeah, I think it should be about like whether once it start hurting you in some way, right?
Yeah.
That's the crossed line for me, essentially.
Yeah. And I think in that situation, it's fine to kind of go, look, I realize you'll probably think you're being very funny and that you can see it's getting reaction from me. But do you understand why this is offensive to people from Western Europe? Because do you actually understand what the Nazis did? Do you understand what Heil Hitler means? I mean, I did
talk about
and
that.
And you have to have that conversation in the end. And, you know, but maybe they're still an asshole after that and they're still doing Heil Hitlers, in which case, I don't know how you then proceed with that within your institution.
They don't. For some reason, I succeeded. But like sometimes this is what we have to go through as teachers as well.
Yeah.
And it's not always this is a teenager, but it's not always teenagers. You would be surprised.
Yeah.
It could be adults with their views, as for example you.
Yeah, yeah.
You pointed and out. Yeah.
It took me a while to learn how to negotiate that in the classroom and how I wanted to kind of be able to manage those situations in a way that didn't completely alienate the person who was making the comment, but also allowed the rest of the class to understand that I'd seen it, I understood it, and I wasn't going to let it go. Because I think in a way, you're also letting down everyone else in the class if you don't address it.
Of course.
You know, and the rest of the class is kind of watching that going, what, you're going to just let this go? This is okay.
Yeah. No.
You know, how's that work?
And then they will respect you after that anyway.
Yeah, or exactly.
They may not necessarily respect you for that view, but they will respect you for having a view or for having a strong...
And saying, look, this is the line. Yeah. And
principle, you know, having a strong principle, you know, that's kind of, what's the word for it? Not like sexy, but it's admirable or it's the wrong word, but you know what I meant.
Yeah.
Anyway, Hugh, I could talk about this with you for ages. I mean, it's really great to pick your brain, and thank you very much for being on the next English podcast.
Thank you, and send me a link when it's ready. And I will.
And,
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much for your work, Zdenek, and for getting in touch. And for
you're very welcome, Hugh. Once again, if you want to check out Hugh Deller and his work, go to English Lab, Language Lab, Lexical Lab. I'm so sorry, LexicalLab.com.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's an alliteration there, Lexical Lab. Yeah.
And up the Arsenal and Slava Ukraine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take care, Zdenek. Yeah.
You too, Hugh. And all right, good mate. Luck. Take care.
Hi, my name is Oriana and I am from Poland. I like the Achievers Chamber because it's a place where I can learn English in an enjoyable way without getting bored.
Thanks a lot for listening. For more information, visit my new website teachersdenek.com, where you can find out about my speaking group for high-level English learners called the Achievers Chamber and download my free course, Unlocking Your English Potential, 8 Secrets to Fluency. That's teachersdenek.com.